Welcome, everybody, to the Out of Chicago podcast. My name is Michael Novo, and this week my guest is Brian Peterson, and our talk is really going to be about photographic exposure. So I'd like to welcome to the show somebody who, I will say this, and this is the only guest that I can really say this about. His book is sort of the reason that I'm a photographer today. I was always kind of a hobbyist and dangled around with the sport, but I really never understood the difference between what, you know, your apertures are and why I would use one over the other, really what the difference is between ISOs, other than I think there's more grain in one of them or something like that. Things that I never really understood all became crystal clear to me when it was suggested that I read a book called Understanding Exposure, and that was by author and photographer by the name of Brian Peterson. So I'd like to welcome to the show, Brian. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Michael. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
It's kind of trippy to be sitting here with you because you're that book, and I remember I was sitting in my corporate cubicle there that was flipping through the book, and here's the difference, and I've flipped through many a book. So you wrote it in this form of English that just made sense, and it said, like, okay, well, you know, your aperture of, what is it, between 5, 6, and 11, you know, that's your whatever aperture. You just need a photo, and I was like, oh, okay, so if I'm taking, like, a quick shot of something for eBay, maybe I'll flip the camera to F8 because, you know, it puts it more in focus, and then you said, but if you want to isolate something, and you showed a photo of a flower in the book, and I think this is like two or three versions ago of the book.
Correct.
Then you're like, and then you want to isolate it, and you want to use it this way. You didn't say, like, right away, okay, you get this shallow depth of field, because as a beginner, I didn't know, like, if the first words being shallow depth of field, what that meant. So it was totally awesome. Got me to a point that really allowed my photography to bloom. So thanks a lot for writing the book.
Hey, my pleasure. You know, quite honestly, that came from the days back in film when I would buy a roll of Kodak film and you'd open it up with a piece of paper and it would have these little cartoons and it would say, if it's bright sunny day at the beach or in the mountains, use F22.
Right.
And if it's a cloudy day, use F4.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is kind of weird because those two apertures affect depth of field. But according to Kodak, it's only choices you're making because it's either bright or dark. So you use small hole or big hole.
Right.
And I was thinking, but that has an impact. What if you don't want to use a small hole and it's a sunny day? What if you want to use a big hole? And so I started thinking about this, and next thing you know, I said, no, wait a minute. We should think about it regardless of a cloudy day or sunny day. Your choice in aperture has a tremendous impact on the visual weight of a photograph vis-a-vis depth of field.
Right.
So that kind of started the whole book idea.
So the Kodak is almost like a general, like, okay, you can start with this suggestion, because they're thinking all about protecting the exposure. They don't want you
correct
to overexpose.
Yeah, there's two kinds of exposure. There's a correct exposure, and then there's a what I call a very thought-provoking, creative, visual weight exposure. So you can have 6 correct exposures with every scene in front of you. F4 at 1,000th is the same as 5.6 at a 500th, and F8 at a 250th, and F11 at 125th, and so on. They're all the same exact exposure. They're all correct. But the visual weight, because of the impact to depth of field, and of course when paired with lens choice, can be dramatic sometimes.
Yeah.
So you're saying, well, it's a bright day, I better use 22. No, you use a 22 only because bright day or cloudy day, you use 22 because you want a massive depth of field, not because if it's bright or if it's dark.
Right.
And people go, oh, that's a new way of thinking, and it's really not, but it's my way of thinking, so thus, again, I wrote the book.
Yeah.
Something people don't know, that book was actually rejected.
And the
Understanding Exposure. It was turned down by the same publisher that had just published 2 years prior the first book I ever did, which was Learning to See Creatively. The editor of that first book had moved on from the publisher's house to pursue a career in anthropology. So I have a new editor who gets my proposal. And this editor says, in so many words, oh, you can't possibly be serious about this. I mean, you've made it so dummied down that it's an assault to the photographic community.
Right.
We can't do this. This would be embarrassing.
And you not only did that, but the book is not, I'm not picking up some 500-page manual.
No, not at all.
Shooting. It's a very, you can sit down and over the course of a week or two, reading a few pages per day, make it through, and very easily implement those concepts, too.
Yeah, I know that for a fact, because I've obviously done workshops all over the world, and people have told me, you know, your book has done this, and it really changed things for me, blah, blah, blah. You know, they know the difference between a correct exposure and a creatively correct exposure. And fortunately, this woman who left to be an anthropologist, came back 6 months after the book had been turned down. This initial editor got fired. She got her job back, the woman who had left. And she subsequently went on to say, in so many words, I went through the files, I saw this thing, and my God, we got to do this book. And I said, well, okay then. So it breathed new life into the idea. And since 1990, we're now working on our fourth edition.
Yeah. I think, I don't remember if I have volume edition two or edition three. I think it has a little house on the cover.
That's number two.
Number two. Okay. Yep. So mm-hmm. maybe I should update just for the fun of it. It's also sold quite a bit. I think it's one of the high selling photography books.
Well, if by an independent author, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Joy of Photography and More Joy of Photography, both published by Kodak, sold bazillions of copies. The Time Life Library sold bazillions of copies.
Okay.
Neither of which are available except at places like eBay, used bookstores, and things like that. But Understanding Exposure, he eclipsed the million mark, I believe it was last year. I honestly wasn't aware of it. I was told by my publisher, keeping in mind this is also in 9 languages.
Yeah.
But it's pretty cool.
Did you do it in all 9 languages yourself? Like, were you translating into Russian?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I could do it in 10, but I only speak 9 languages.
Oh, okay. So. There you go. Yeah. No, and you know, I don't want the listeners just to think that this is like some like commercial for the book or anything like that, but it's something that really made a difference. Like, there's so many tools out there in the photographic world that we can use, but it's there's some really select ones that stick with me, and that book was one. It sits on my shelf to this day. It's one of the few. When a new photographer comes to me and says, you know, what should I do, what videos do you suggest, I'm like, you know what, do this. Like, I think you need to sometimes videos are great to look at online, and I love those, but just before you do that, like, sit down with the fundamentals. Sit down with a piece of paper. Have your camera right there and just, like, look at something. Change the setting on your camera and see what you come up with. So that's really why I suggest it. But you also do other things. You've got videos that you do. In general, you are an educator. Somewhere in there, you're a photographer as well, too. So from time to time.
Well, I spent a number of years doing full-time commercial work. I did that for almost 25 years and then taught on the side. And now it's flipped. I'm doing still commercial work for one specific client, which takes me around the world. But beyond that, I have an online photo school, and I do workshops as well, both domestic and international, every year.
You're the You Keep Shooting guy.
Yeah, and I also do the videos that I offer at the school, as well as for Adorama, the camera store. And Adorama and I as well, I mean, we promote these as You Keep Shooting with Brian Peterson, because it just became a tagline years ago when I first started doing videos. And it wasn't planned. There was no script. But when the video stopped just before an end, I said, hey, this is Brian Peterson. Until next time, you keep shooting. And I start saying that every time I brought the video to a close. And now it's become one of those things in the photographic community where people will email me and they'll ask a question, or they'll simply say, hey, I saw your videos or I saw your books and good stuff, blah, blah, blah. But hey, don't you worry, Brian, I'll keep shooting.
There you go.
So I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to do something with that. So I trademarked You Keep Shooting. And starting in September, we will be launching a website called youkeepshooting.com, where we'll have all the videos in one central location. Public, available. They're yours to look at for free. But like everything in life, there will be other opportunities. If you want to spend money, go to You Keep Shooting, and you can also spend money too if you want.
Right.
So we'll have things there that you can continue the education in exchange for a very small amount of money each month. But it'll be new videos each month coming at you, as well as a opportunity to do a Q&A, participate in webinars, participate in actual critiques of your work, and even monthly photo contest, among other things.
That's very cool. So a lot of information. Now, if you're, let's say you're the new photographer, we're recording this at the Out of Chicago conference right now. We found a nice little quiet area. And so I'm newer to photography. I've had this weekend, and it's been a ton of overwhelming information, but I'm relatively new. Let's say we got my camera like a year ago or 6 months ago, and I really want to kind of take it to the next level. What steps do you suggest that photographers take in terms of like improving just their portraits for their personal sake and getting something that their friends and family not just look at and say like, wow, that's a nice photo of my niece, but really say like, wow, that's a great photo. Like how do you go from just having my camera in auto mode to being a fluid with it in manual mode, just dive into it piece by piece?
Again, without, like you say, we're trying to hammer home this book, understanding exposure is a great place to begin in terms of understanding the principles of depth of field, aperture choice, as well as the impact of that when combined with lens choice. So let's assume you're beyond that. You know that 5.6 with telephoto lenses or f4 with a telephoto lens gives you what I call knockout backgrounds. But that doesn't mean that you can't also introduce your own backgrounds. People have no question when they go to a studio that the photographer's gonna pull down a seamless background, gray, white, or black. There's nothing to prevent you from making a side trip to Joann Fabrics and purchasing some beautiful floral color patterns of fabric and making these your background, where you then have several family members or friends hold these up, you know, at some distance. Let's say you're gonna shoot a portrait of your sister's three-year-old daughter, and she's got her little pretty dress on, and you sit her down in the grass, but the background is nothing but a bunch of bleachers from the baseball field. Right. So your job is to 15 feet beyond that, just like as if you're in a studio, you pull out this floral fabric, have people hold it, you shoot with the telephoto lens, and all of a sudden she's sitting in green grass, the background goes into this out-of-focus tones of colors and complements the dress she's wearing, and people go, whoa, what is that? Are you in Bouchard Gardens or something? And you think, no, man, it's just a piece of fabric from Joann's Fabric. That would be one place that I know would improve portraits dramatically. The second thing is to get in so tight that compositionally you're actually cropping in to about the top of the forehead.
Yeah.
Now, not so much with kids, although that's effective, but definitely with adults and teenagers, because that creates a much greater sense and heightened sense of intimacy. And to do that effectively, I believe, from experience again, focal lengths from 2 to 300 are ideal for that. So,
how are you taking that, you know, my textbook knowledge? Because, and I sort of, I don't know how I made the transition, because I feel like, so I read the book and then started practicing and the technical knowledge I had. So now I can say that, okay, at F4, I am going to get that shallow depth of field and I understand the concept of what's happening there. How do you take the photo from being a snapshot that anybody that walking by could have happened to take at that aperture to something that's a photograph that stands out on its own? What is there any advice that you have for new photographers to for them to have their unique vision or voice come through, so that when they look at a photo, they say like, okay, that's a Brian Peterson photo, or that's a Michael Novo photo? What suggestions do you have to go in that direction?
Well, I think that with regard to even things like lens choice, I'm not suggesting that you have to shoot all your portraits at 2 to 300. You may be one of these people who wants to shoot portraits with a 35 millimeter or a 50 millimeter 1.4, whatever the case might be, but ultimately, it's you making the decision to frame the shot up to include, let's again, go to the three-year-old. She's sitting down with her legs crossed. She's got the pretty dress on. If you want to go in and shoot just her face, then you're going to shoot just her face. If you're going to shoot the entire body, then you're going to shoot the entire body. But I will say this, and it can't be overstated, the lighting of that is obviously important. If you're going to be stuck having to go out and shoot, for example, at 1 o'clock or 12 o'clock or 11 o'clock in the morning, there is one extra thing you might want to consider, and that is to take a 36 inch diameter diffuser and have somebody hold it over the head of the little girl, so the light then is over her is incredibly even. That would be another idea. But as far as overall compositionally, the one thing I've told students over and over and over, because we're all guilty of blowing things out of proportion. And what I mean by that is that you actually think you're filling up the frame when in fact you haven't. And not filling up the frame when you photograph that portrait has included to the left of her the backstop of the softball field. Or it's included on the right side, the front end of the parked red Pontiac in the parking lot off to the right. And you think, well, I'll crop it later in Photoshop. When in fact you could physically zoom with your feet, get in closer and fill up the frame even more. So compositionally speaking, I've seen it over and over and over that most photographs taken within the first couple of years of a photographer's beginning all could benefit from getting closer. And so if nothing else, I've told students, get in so close that the subject is left the frame. and from that point start to back up. It's easier to go in reverse than it is to go forward. So if you get so close that you're literally on top of these people, great. Now you can start backing off.
Right.
So.
And I'll say that still applies to me to this day. I could be shooting some sort of event. I've never, maybe it's happened one out of every, you know, few thousand photos, but never wish that I was too tight on that photo. If anything, I'm always, all right, let me just crop in a little bit. And you're sitting there doing this batch edit and you just crop in, crop in, crop in. And it could have been done and you do hesitate a little bit. So yeah, it I would say that, you know, even on I don't, not that I'm some amazing level, but even on my level today, now that I know how to shoot events, I'm still finding that I'm, you know, you could crop in a little bit tighter there because all of that extra stuff doesn't matter. And yeah, that's one of the biggest things when people bring a portfolio review. I'm like, why do you have the back of that guy's head in there and the back of her head in there? When you're really photographing the person that's in between them, that's all we want to see. So why are you showing the whole thing?
Yep.
So yeah, absolutely. It works that way. What else? What else is something that would be a good tip for new photographers?
I've said this as an illustration, but it makes perfect sense. But I've been very fortunate. On two occasions, I've moved to Europe and lived in Bavaria, Germany. I lived in Amsterdam over the course of about 2.5 years. I then returned to the States and went back about 7 years later and lived in France. Spent 10 years living in the south of France. In both cases, in those countries, not surprising, you learn how to speak German. Mm-hmm. You learn how to speak French. You learn how to speak a little bit of Dutch. In the camera bag of every single photographer is a foreign language. And when they go out and buy this lens, that has a visual language unique to that lens. No one will argue that a fisheye has a very unique language that no one would confuse. When I say no one, I mean someone with experience, is going to look at a shot with a fisheye and say, oh, is that with your 300? Right away, you're thinking, oh, yeah, a fisheye. It's a very distinct language. It's kind of like having a British person speaking with a Cockney accent. Right away, you say, oh, my God, that guy speaks with a Cockney accent. That would be like a fisheye lens. Everybody else, oh, they all sound the same. Likewise, I mean, unlike what's in your bag, a 28-millimeter lens has a completely different language than a 300. And again, I'm speaking, obviously, visual language. And I am continually amazed, in the workshops especially, people who attend the workshops. And I understand why they're coming, because they want to expand their vision. They want to get nice pictures of lavender fields or tulip fields with windmills, or they want to get pictures of New York City on the street, whatever the case might be. Yet, they struggle. They'll look at me and they'll say, what lens would you recommend? And I go, well, what is it you want to shoot? Well, we're going to Times Square, right? And I said, that's where we're headed. And they go, well, what lens would you recommend? And I say, let's just do
the right lens.
Let's do a street zoom. And they go, well, what would you call a street zoom? And I'm thinking, well, that's a fair question. 24-105, 24-120, 24-70. Okay, good. I'm not sure which one that is, but can you help me out with that? I'm thinking, that's unfortunate. You got four lenses in your bag, and you don't know which one's a 24 to 70. And yes, I don't have a lot of time to do this. That's why I signed up for the workshop. I just want to do nothing but concentrate on photography. Okay, that's fair. But let's do that concentration with the emphasis on the vision of this lens. So during the course of that workshop, for good reason, I will have students hold a lens to their eye as we leave the hotel and walk to Times Square. In this case, about 7 blocks. And I say, put it at 24. You put yours at 70. You put yours at 120. One eye open to keep yourself on the street, on the straight and narrow, but the other eye be looking and focus in and out as you walk up the street. And tilt your camera up and down. And by the time we get there, tell me what you notice. And you people will come and they'll say, my God, I didn't know that, but this lens could do that. I had no idea. This is kind of cool. So that's the, oh, this is that look. I've seen this in pictures. Okay, that's what this lens does. If they would do that repeatedly, then it becomes a real challenge to be in the car driving down the road and you are bombarded with so much images because you're thinking, oh my God, look at that wide angle shot I just drove past. Oh my God, look at that straight ahead. That's a 400 millimeter if I've ever seen one.
Right.
All of a sudden, things like Times Square with all of its signage becomes an amazing place to turn into out of focus shapes of tones of shapes and color. And you're thinking, my God, I've always thought about doing this in focus. But now that I use my 300 millimeter 4 blocks away and made it go out of focus, it's like, what an amazing background this could become.
Yeah.
and your vision starts to expand. In effect, you hang out enough with your lenses, you're speaking French or you're speaking German, metaphorically.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I have sort of, and might seem off topic, but I've been in the world of like cars and motorcycles. I used to be a motorcycle repair guy, and right next door to our shop was a car place. And so the guy would fix cars, but he also would soup them up. So a lot of sports cars would come in. And one guy comes rolling in one day who had some turbo system put into his car. And I happen to be standing there with the owner of the car shop. Guy comes rolling in on his car and he's like, you know what? My car is, it just doesn't feel that fast. It's supposed to feel faster, but it doesn't feel fast. And so the owner, who is just like this old guy, like kind of short, he gets in the car with him. And so I'm heading back and I hear them all of a sudden, like the radio in the car is just booming. I can hear it very clearly outside of the car. They take off for the drive and then they come back with the guy. And I said, why did you have the radio so loud? And he's like, the guy was thinking that his car's like, he's using it. He just said, that's the tool and it's supposed to do this job. But rather than take the car and use it, he wasn't, you know, he was shifting too early. He was misusing his tool. He just didn't know how to use his car as the tool to get it to do the things that he wanted. I turned up the volume all the way because I didn't want him to listen to his engine because he thinks that he's listening and reacting to it rather than just feeling it and mm-hmm. using it as a tool. So it's one of those things where I understand what you're saying. I pull out my lenses now and I know that, okay, this is what I want to accomplish from this lens. And so sometimes I have to stop a photo in the middle of it because I know like my 70 is not enough. I have to back up a little bit, take it to 105, and somebody will look at me and say, like, but you're wasting, you know, a minute or two to right. swap lenses for 30, but it's going to get me that exact thing. It's sure. going to turn up, crank up that volume. So yeah, it's yep. it's really knowing your gear. And that's where I see people sometimes with amazingly cheap gear outperform and outshine people who have like this, the state-of-the-art modern gear, because that's what it really boils down to.
Well, I agree with you. At the same time, this is obviously assuming that one knows their equipment. And what I mean by that is this. If you know your equipment, then it becomes paramount that you show up for the job with the right equipment as well. And I'm saying that for this reason, because, you know, there's, and I understand where it's coming from, but this idea that, you know, what kind of camera do you have? You know, whatever camera's in my hand. the fact is, you can't shoot the Super Bowl as a sports photographer with an iPhone.
Right.
Or with a point and shoot. But you sure as hell could with a 600 on a Canon 5D Mark III or an Icon D5. Okay, no problem. That's what you're expected to show up with. So, again, yes, equipment's important for the right, you know, right piece of equipment for the job. So it isn't because necessarily one guy has better equipment, as you just said. I could have not as good of equipment, but I'm going to be limited by that equipment. And by limited, I mean each piece of gear, even an iPhone, is limited. Just the iPhone itself, not accessories, but just right. the iPhone itself is limited in its vision.
Right.
As a result, I'm going to be limited in what I can shoot. Sure, I'll get some good shots with it, but within limits. Likewise, if I just leave the house with a 600 on me, boy, am I ever limited. Somebody says, hey, look at that wide angle shot. You can get that foreground flowers with the Rockies in the background. Not with a 600, I won't.
Yeah.
So know your gear. So when you then proceed out into this foreign land, if you stumble into France, you speak French. If you stumble in Germany, you're ready to speak German. That's meaning, a, got the wide angle, I got the telephoto, I got the macro, I got the fisheye, I got the super telephoto. I can pretty much go all over Europe and speak the language.
Right.
So metaphorically. Obviously.
No, that's a great way. That's a great way to put it. And I think that that's what helped me as a new photographer, and I think helps other folks. It just sort of simplifies it because I can sit there and look at technical specs. So, you know, I'm getting into bicycling now, so when I was looking at this road bike or that road bike, you're sitting there and looking at the specs, and then to have you have this nice fancy fast road bike, and all of a sudden a guy on a mountain bike blows by you, you know, at twice your speed. It's like it boils down to just, you know, you have to get out there. And pedal is what another photographer, Tim Wallace, has told me. And so, yeah, at some point, get on, use the tools that you have, and then once you've hit those limits, then go ahead and pick up the next thing. Yeah. You know, hopefully by the time you're shooting the Super Bowl, you've shot enough, you know, sports games of like your kids maybe, or high school, mm-hmm. or college. But you know, you've progressed up. You're not just yeah. buying the latest gear and saying, you know what, I'm going to go shoot the Super Bowl tomorrow. So,
well, one of the downsides to today's photographic community, as well as the retail end, is that when you go to the store to buy, unlike the day when I started, which was 1970, I get a Nikkormat at the camera store and a 50mm 1.8 lens. Mm-hmm. That was expensive. So for the next 9 months, that's all I had. So you learn to zoom with your feet. You learn to use a foot drone and climb stairs and shoot from above down.
A foot drone, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
And by God, you save up enough money and you go, oh, I finally got enough to get my 200mm f4. So you go get a 200mm. Nobody would buy a zoom back then. First of all, they were just coming on the market, and boy, were they optically horrible. Mm-hmm. So you bought a fixed lens. A prime is the, you know, the famous word, not right. famous, but the overused word. And after the 200, started saving up for my 28 f3.5. So now I'm spending 9 months with a 50, 6 months with a 200. Now I finally got enough to get the 28. That threw me off. I thought, who the hell would want to buy this thing? What did I buy this for? It makes everything small and distant. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until one day, and it was all because of the voice that came out of the ground, as I would call it, when I say, metaphorically, but I'm hearing crickets down in the grass, and I went down in the grass just to go dig around looking for crickets, having with me a 28, but not looking through the lens. And at that point, the lens was in my way, and the camera, and I pushed it aside momentarily. And it was a fall as well. Leaves were on the ground. I was in a cherry orchard. I remember this vividly. And somehow, some way, I remember I grabbed the lens and I just didn't want to get up and say, oh, what the hell? And I just put the lens up to my eye. And I had this massive foreground of beautiful fall-colored cherry leaves in front of me. And I said, and then beyond that, this wonderful converging parallel lines of rows of cherry trees through this cherry orchard. And I just went, oh my God, this is incredible. And then I realized, you know, the key to using this lens is it makes everything small and distant. It pushes back everything because it says, okay, I'm gonna push everything back so you can have a wonderful foreground of immediate foreground interest. And I'm thinking, okay, that's how you use this lens. And shortly after that, probably 3 or 4 years later, no, and I mean 3 or 4 months later, I started paying attention to the likes of Ansel Adams, not him specifically, but people using 4x5 view cameras, shooting color, because I didn't like black and white. And I started picking up on people like David Munch, whose son Mark has taken over the business. This is an Arizona Highways people. I mean, not, I don't know if Mark's doing Arizona Highways, and I apologize for not knowing that. But David was. And David would have this barrel cactus in the foreground. Just massive blooms and then more cactus in the background and blue sky and white puffy clouds. And right away I said, he's using a wide angle. You know, I mean, I could recognize it and it felt so good to find out that I was right. And then it became, okay, wide angle lens, you know what you do with that? You always use foreground interest. Again, it's not an absolute, but by God, 90% of the time, every person who uses a wide angle are almost there. But they fail to drop to their knees and shoot foreground interest.
Yeah.
It doesn't do a whole lot of good to stand in a field of tulips or lavender and shoot a wide-angle lens because, trust me, everything's been pushed back out of the way and there's nothing there to invite the viewer in. So get a leading line of lavender fields and use that in the foreground and, oh, my God, you're winning contests.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, this has definitely been some fantastic information. If we have some folks that are listening to this and they want to connect with you or find out more information about your books, or you have workshops, I believe, too, that you're going to be leading as well. So where can they go?
I'm one of those people that I have absolutely no problem and welcome your emails, which is my name, BrianFPeterson@mac.com. I'm not necessarily able to answer those within an hour, but certainly within a day or two, believe it or not. And you will get an answer from me personally. In addition, I do have, and I was going to mention that earlier, I've also got the third edition of Learning to See Creatively that is now out, completely updated. And that's all about what we just discussed in terms of understanding the language of your lenses and the elements of design, as well as a little bit of compositional stuff. I do workshops, BrianFPetersonPhotoWorkshops.com. And the new schedule for 2017 will be out Labor Day weekend.
And that's Brian with a Y, too.
Brian with a Y, yeah. And then, as I mentioned, keep an eye on youkeepshooting.com, and the doors will be open shortly after Labor Day.
Well, very cool. Mr. Brian Peterson, thank you so much for your time. I don't want to keep you. I know you have more folks to see. You keep having people to stop by and check out your books here at the conference. So I'll let you get back. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your books. They help. They not only help, you know, the people who are out there now, but I think I'm sort of a testament to the fact that, you know, it definitely helped propel me to where I am. So thank you so much again.
Thank you, Michael. And thanks to everyone out there who's bought the books, because it's truly humbling. And more than that, it means a great deal to my daughters in college, because it's helping pay the bills.
Absolutely. There you go. Brian Peterson, take care.
Thank you.